600 miles from land. You're on a small boat in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. There is no GPS, no GIS. In fact, there's not even a radio. It's just you, the vast ocean, and the skies. How do you navigate on the open seas? How do you find your way home? This is a challenge that humans have faced for centuries until a revolutionary invention in 1757. The animal kingdom had already solved the problem in a range of ingenious ways. Welcome to What's Your Map? An Oculi Mundi exploration. I'm Jerry Broughton, a map historian. In this podcast, we hear from those who live, love, and work with maps, making, preserving, interpreting, and being inspired by them. In each episode, we ask our guests to unfold a map that is special to them and to tell us the story that lies behind it. To follow the map as we talk about it on this podcast, go to oculi-mundi.com. As a sailor and navigator, David Barry has always been captivated by the stars as a navigational tool. It created a sense of wonder in him from a young age. His first book, Sextant, chronicled the history of celestial navigation alongside his own personal journey sailing across the Atlantic. His second book, Incredible Journeys, about the extraordinary ways animals navigate, was the Sunday Times Nature Book of the Year. He's also a fellow of the Royal Institute of Navigation. David, welcome to What's Your Map?
Well, it's lovely to be here.
Well, it's lovely to be here with a map, which you have in front of us here, which we're going to look at. Tell me about your map. Let's have a look at it.
Well, this is a chart of the North Atlantic Ocean, and it's framed and it hangs over the desk where I write. And it records in the form of little pencil crosses the route that I followed back in 1973 when I was sailing in an old 35-foot wooden yacht called Sequin, Sea Queen in Anglo-Saxon, from Halifax, Nova Scotia, to Falmouth in Cornwall. And that was for me, though I suppose I didn't know it at the time, but it was a really formative experience. The most important thing about it was that it gave me the chance to learn something that I'd been interested in for a long time, which was how to navigate with a sextant.
So for somebody who's looking at this map who doesn't sail, let's just understand what's going on with these numbers and also the blue shading. As a chart for sailing, just what are the actual technical dimensions here and what we're seeing?
So it's a huge expanse of ocean and indeed land. So on the left-hand side, you've got the whole of Labrador, the whole of Newfoundland, Nova Scotia, New England, the east coast of the United States, all the way down to Florida and the Bahamas. On the eastern side, top right-hand corner, you've got the Faroe Islands, and then you've got Shetland, Orkney, the British Isles, France, Spain, Morocco, and then right the way down to the Canaries, and roughly sort of in the middle, you've got the Azores. But most of the chart is taken up with ocean. It's got a grid. It shows latitude and longitude. So latitude is north and south. Longitude is east and west. Because it's a very small-scale chart, it makes a simple distinction between very deep water and slightly shallower water. So the shallower water, the sort of continental shelf, is marked in a light blue shade, whereas the deeper kind of abysmal depths of the ocean are all white, but you can get a sense of the topography of the ocean by looking at these numbers, which are called soundings. And a sounding is very simply the depth of water that has been measured at the given location. And it's rather humbling to consider the astonishing effort that must have gone into making all of these. These soundings would have been taken not with an echo sounder, but with a piece of lead on the end of probably a wire, actually, because the water is so deep. And the lead would have been dropped over the side of a stationary ship, and it would have whizzed down and down and down and down. And some of the soundings on here are 2,500, 2,600 fathoms. A fathom is 6 feet. So the thing goes whizzing down. You can detect when it's hit the bottom because the wire kind of goes slack. And then you can read off from the wire, which has some kind of graduation on it, what that depth reading is. And that's great. But of course, you've then got to work out exactly where the ship is. So a sounding is both a depth and a location.
David, on this chart, you have soundings and you also have your own little annotations. What do they show?
I have to say, I bought this chart, which was exactly like the chart we used on the passage, but I bought this for myself soon after we returned. And I'd kept a journal during the passage, and I very carefully marked with pencil on the chart our daily noon positions. So you see, it starts with number one, which is just off the coast of Nova Scotia, and then it goes across around the Grand Banks and then across the middle of the ocean until I think you get to 23 or 24. So 23 or 4 days out, we're getting back to England.
And then how did you take the measurements, David?
Well, it was using a sextant. And in the old days, the only way to determine your location was celestial. You needed a sextant. You needed to observe the sun, the stars, the moon, the planets.
Tell us about the sextant. When did you first come across what a sextant is?
I first handled a sextant on the voyage from Halifax.
So this was in 1973?
In 1973. I knew about sextants. I think I'd seen a sextant. But the first time I actually handled one was when Colin McMullen, who was the skipper of this boat, who was, I then thought of him as a very old man. He was all of 67. But he was a very, very experienced navigator who'd been in the Navy, who'd served in the Second World War. And he handed the sextant to me. And I remember it vividly because he said, "Don't drop it. You know, if you drop it, it'll cause all kinds of problems." So had to be very careful. Care of the sextant, very important. And the one of the astonishing things about the sextant is that it was a development of a thing called the quadrant. It was a slightly larger and more elaborate version of this instrument. And the first ones were made in the 1750s. And the astonishing thing is that a modern sextant differs hardly at all from a sextant made in the 1750s, because these things were, it was kind of born perfect.
Just explain, what exactly is a sextant and what does it do and how does it enable you effectively to get from A to B?
That's a lot of questions.
So give me a sort of working definition of a sextant.
So essentially, a sextant is an optical device for measuring angles. Typically, it's used for measuring the vertical angle between the horizon and a heavenly body, which, you know, it's a fancy term for sun, moon, stars, and what have you. It can also measure horizontal angles, so you can use it for either purpose. But the real beauty of it is that it relies on the principle of double reflection, which is a fancy way of saying that when you look through the little telescope, you look into a mirror that is divided. One half is silvered, one half is clear. So you can see through the clear half at the horizon, and in the mirrored half, you can see the reflection of a heavenly body in a second mirror, which is attached to the index arm. So as you move the index arm, the top mirror moves, and you can pick up whatever it is you want to look at in the sky. So it might be the sun, for example. The first sight I ever did was a meridian altitude, the height of the sun at noon as it crosses your meridian. And what you see when you look through the little telescope, you have shades to protect your eye from the brightness of the sun, of course, and you just see this bright white disc. And using that index arm, adjusting that upper mirror, you can bring the disc down to the horizon, and then you can measure the height. And the beauty of this, the thing that's sort of magic about it, is that because of this principle, it doesn't really matter what the vessel is doing. It can be bouncing around all over the place. So long as you keep the sextant pointed at the horizon, everything is frozen.
But can you? I'm always curious about this as somebody who's sailed a bit, not to your level. And you're pitching and rolling. Well, how does this work, David?
So I have to admit, there is an element of skill involved,
yeah,
and practice.
Yeah.
So the first time you pick one up, yeah, it isn't that easy.
Yeah.
But once you've got the hang of it, even if there's quite a sea running, providing you're well kind of braced, you can actually get a good sight, even when the boat is bouncing all over the place. The bigger problem actually then is probably going to be spray,
yeah,
coming over the mirrors,
and that
you don't want.
Yeah.
But it's a very, very beautiful device. The original concept, I think, is owed to Isaac Newton.
We are finding out here, aren't we, the immensely difficult mathematical dimensions of navigation to cross, especially a vast piece of sea like the Atlantic. What you've got here with the sextant is a way of creating angles in relation to the surface of the Earth and to celestial bodies. And once you can consistently do that, you can start to see where you are on the Earth, and you can then map your movements across it. But there's complex maths here, isn't there?
Oh, yeah.
And then, as you say, longitude, which many people may know, Darvas Sabel wrote this great book about how you invented longitude. You had to have accurate measurement of time at sea. John Harrison, the great Yorkshireman, may I say, Yorkshireman who invented the chronometer which allowed longitude to be cracked. But these are very, very complex forms of mathematical techniques that are required. But for you, you were beguiled by this, weren't you? The sextant, for you, captured something, not just about science and mathematics, but something about the wonder of navigation and the sea and the stars. You are beguiled, aren't you, by it?
I think celestial navigation is really one of the most wonderful human achievements. And I suppose the reason why I'm entranced by it is that it seems so utterly wonderful that a tiny speck of life on the surface of this planet can look up at the sun, a mere 93 million miles away, or you can look up at a neighbouring star that is perhaps 10, 20, 30, or 100 light years away, or you could be looking at something even more distant. And you can use the light from these unimaginably distant celestial objects to fix your position on the surface of the planet. And I find that extraordinarily, it's sublime. And the fact that it depends on the work of generation after generation of extraordinarily gifted and dedicated astronomers, mathematicians, instrument makers. I mean, it's an edifice that reflects the work of, many, many thousands of brilliant people. And to revert for a moment to the chart, these charts, like the one that we've been discussing, represent the fruit of all of that extraordinary intellectual and practical endeavour.
David's wonderful chart really plots scientific advancement and human inventiveness when it comes to navigation. Using a sextant and being able to figure out where you are in the middle of an ocean by using the stars is utterly beguiling. So I understand where David's enthusiasm comes from. Before we hear more about David's 1973 crossing, when he was just 19 years old, I'd love for you to join our global community of explorers by subscribing to this podcast. From mapping the cosmos to journeying to the North Pole, we have a wealth of episodes for you to enjoy. And subscribing means you won't miss a single new map, guest, or story from this series or the next. Now, back to hearing more about David's adventure. Tell me about the voyage itself and your own background. Where did you get that love for navigation and interest in sailing from? And why did you end up on the boat in 1973?
Well, this is an example of sheer luck and privilege. I was brought up in the town of Lymington on the south coast of England. You know, there were lots and lots of people who sailed. My family sailed. We knew lots of people who sailed. And Colin McMullen was a family friend. I did some sailing with him, and he was planning a trip in his yacht, Sequin, to the United States, and he needed some crew to help him bring her back. And he rang up and said, you know, David, would you like to do it? And I leapt at the opportunity. I was then a student, and it fitted in with my summer vacation. And it was a great, great privilege.
Give me a sense of the day-to-day reality of doing that crossing. Are you taking readings regularly? How is it relating to weather and conditions? What's happening on that voyage, David?
Well, the thing about an ocean passage in a yacht is that it's very intense, and you live very much in the moment. I can remember, you know, I was 19 years old, and I remember being obsessed by what I was going to eat. You know, what was the next meal going to be?
But it is important.
But it was important.
Yeah.
It's a very, very curious mixture, because you live in the moment, and the quality of the moment, whether it's a good moment or a bad moment, is largely dictated by the weather.
Mm.
So if the weather is fine and you're whizzing along, as we did for parts of the voyage, it's utterly delightful.
Mm.
And you sit back and you enjoy the sun and you see the birds and you see the fish, and you take your sextant sights and you plot them on the chart. But as soon as the weather starts to get nasty, and we did have one quite heavy gale in the middle of the Atlantic, and that was extremely uncomfortable, wet, cold, and frankly frightening to me. Colin didn't think much of it, you know, right. He'd seen much worse. But I have to admit, we did something called lying a hull in the middle of it, which means taking all the sails down and just allowing the seas to kind of push you along. And it was very odd, because we just hunkered down below.
Mm.
Nobody was on watch.
Mm.
And kind of waited for this thing to pass. And in fact, we were woken up by the horn of a ship. And I remember staggering up onto the deck, and there was this bloody great merchant vessel bearing down on us. They'd spotted us on their radar.
Right.
And in those days, I should have explained that in 1973, a transatlantic crossing in a small yacht was actually quite an unusual thing. I mean, it's a completely routine now. And one of the reasons it's completely routine is because navigation has become so much easier. Anyway, this ship had seen us, obviously puzzled, and they were coming to see what was going on. And I remember they came actually dangerously close to us, and they tried to hail from, you know, the deck was 30 feet up, and we couldn't hear them, and there were big seas breaking everywhere.
Mm.
Eventually, we had to just get away from them, because our mast was swinging from side to side, and if it had touched the side of the ship, we would have been dismasted instantly, and we'd have been in real trouble.
Mm.
And the other thing I should say about a long ocean voyage is that, frankly, a lot of it's intensely boring.
Yes.
And there's this constant sense of how long is it going to be?
Mm.
I remember going up to the bows, the furthest away I could get, and sort of screaming.
But you can.
Yes, you could. I was inaudible. But it was a very curious mixture of excitement, fear, exaltation, and above all, a complete immersion in the natural world and in the moment. And that, of course, is quite a rare thing. And I suppose it was that, more than anything, that affected me. And when I talk about the natural world, I'm not talking about just the Earth. I'm talking about the cosmos, because at night you're far from land. There's no light pollution.
Mm.
And if it's a clear night, it is just majestic.
Humans are unique because they use those instruments. They need that technology, as they need a map in a way that animals don't.
Or do they?
Well, do animals use maps? I mean, this is what I'm interested in. What you should tell me about Incredible Journeys. Just really, how did that move come about from the one to the other? I was really struck by that. I could have imagined you could have carried on and done something much more, you know, developing the ideas about navigation and maritime history. But you went into, if I may say, a journey without maps to some extent.
Yes. Well, I should explain that when I was a student, I mean, at the very moment when I was doing that transatlantic passage, I was studying experimental psychology, which included a lot of animal behavior. So I'd learned all about von Frisch's extraordinary experiments with honeybees and how they navigate and how they can communicate information to their fellow bees about courses and distances. And I did begin doing some research on the latest progress that had been made in animal navigation studies. And when Sextant was out, I said to my agent, you know, I'd like to do a book about animal navigation. And that led eventually to Incredible Journeys. I mean, I knew it was going to be a big job, but I didn't realize quite how big because there wasn't much secondary literature. Not many people had written books about it. It was all papers. So I had 3,000 odd papers on my computer by the end of it.
And my sense is it's still a moving field, because just take us into this complex field about how we understand the ability of the animal kingdom really to move, to migrate, and to retrace their steps, but without what we would see as maps. But the psychology here is fascinating. The neurobiology is moving as we speak, is it not?
It is. My sense, yeah. It is. I mean, it is. I'm completely entranced by it. And I mean, in fact, I find it very difficult to let go. I mean, I wrote the book, but I still read all the research and go to conferences, so slightly mad. But a good example is the desert ant.
Tell me more, because I got a bit of this, but this is a wonderful story.
Well, a desert ant is an ant that lives typically in the Sahara Desert, Cataglyphus fortis. And in the late 19th century, there was a Swiss doctor who was working in Tunisia, who was interested in the natural world, and he observed these ants, and they do something extraordinary. They live, obviously, in a nest under the ground with a tiny entrance hole just big enough for them to get in and out, and they come up to go foraging for dead insects, typically, and they will head out and they'll zigzag around. And eventually, maybe they'll find a dead butterfly and grasp it in their jaws. And they may have gone several hundred meters by now, and it's baking hot. So their survival, actually, to avoid heat exhaustion, depends on their ability to get back very quickly to their nest and get underground. So high premium on their navigational skills. And he observed, time and again, that these little tiny animals would just go straight back to the nest entrance. And he asked a very simple question. How on earth are they doing it? And he did a very simple experiment, which was to put up, he guessed that maybe it had something to do with the sun. So he put up a mirror and he changed the position of the sun in the mirror. And sure enough, the ants went off in the wrong direction. So that was a pretty good clue. And then in the 60s and 70s, there's a wonderful German scientist called Rüdiger Wehner, whom I interviewed in Zurich, who has become one of the absolute kind of key figures in animal navigation studies. And he has spent, I don't know, 50 years with his colleagues working on the navigational toolkit of the desert ant. And what he has shown is, first of all, that the desert ant is a dead reckoning navigator. We haven't talked about dead reckoning, but dead reckoning still is very important, actually, for navigators at sea and for desert ants. And dead reckoning is simply keeping track of your course and the distance and any course changes so that you can always tell what the direction is that leads you back to the place where you started. And Rüdiger Wehner has shown that Cataglyphus fortis is a dead reckoning navigator, path integration, the scientists call it. And to do dead reckoning, you obviously need to be able to measure your course and the distance. So how does the ant do that? Well, Vayner has shown that there's a part of the eye of the desert ant that is specially tuned to detect the polarized light patterns in the sky produced by the sun, and it can use those polarized light patterns to maintain a steady course. Of course, the sun's moving all the time, so that requires a bit of compensation. So it has an internal clock that permits it to do that time compensation. So it's what's called a time-compensated sun compass. Turns out that most insects have this, many other animals, birds and so forth. So it's very widespread in the animal kingdom. So that's the compass bit. So how about the distance? How is the ant measuring its distance? Well, it turns out it sort of counts its steps. And there was a fascinating experiment done some years ago where a scientist working with Vayner attached pig bristles to the legs of the ant to make their legs longer. And in other cases, it sort of amputated the legs to make them shorter. And he then observed what happened. And it turned out, of course, that the ants with stilts, which made their steps longer, tended to overshoot the nest entrance on their return, whereas the amputees stopped short. So this was very, very clear evidence that there was some process of step counting going on. But it turns out to be even more complicated than that, because they can even make allowances for undulations in the ground. It turns out they also have a magnetic compass sense. They can use the wind direction. They're also extremely adept at using landmarks. They can use their sense of smell, though that isn't usually relevant in their environment. So they've got a very elaborate toolkit. All the animals that have been closely studied, whether it's insects, birds, you know, whatever, there's a lot of redundancy. No animal relies on a single sense or a single mechanism to navigate, because that would be very, very likely to lead to disaster.
But we're going very deep here, this sense in which humans, is there a sense in which the cognitive development of the human brain, which of course is much larger, isn't as equipped as many of those animals? And that's why we need maps, because we're not as equipped, even though our brains are bigger. I mean, this is an extraordinary situation that we get into, and we're clearly in a very early development of understanding how this works. But I've always been fascinated by that distinction.
It is fascinating. I just want to qualify what you said in one respect, which is that there are lots of indigenous peoples who actually are astonishingly adept, brilliant navigators without the benefit of any tools or maps. And the most famous being the Pacific Islanders.
Well, it's an interesting one around what, again, it tells us about the neurobiology, about our ability to navigate and what's getting lost in that respect across human history. There's fascinating studies that you know more about than I do about the hippocampus.
Yeah.
And you talk about this, the seahorse brain, that we have this part of the brain which seems to be actually shrinking. And it is our wayfinding sort of cognitive space, this amazing thing of that they did these tests on cabbies doing the knowledge, and their hippocampus had shrunk after they retired. But the way in which we're still really, I think, in the infancy and understanding how the brain works in terms of orientation and wayfinding, and the role that a map plays. And as you say, indigenous cultures seem to tell us that we are hardwired in different ways to move around. The move online, are we losing something? Is it that wonderful phrase you have, the thickness of our encounter with the natural world, that is perhaps being lost because we are all using our smartphones? We aren't looking up. We are literally bumping into each other as we try and get from one place to the other. Are we cognitively losing something in this moment?
Yes, I think it's clear. And I think the evidence is now fast accumulating that our increasing reliance on electronic navigational aids is seriously reducing our ability to navigate, if you like, naturally, because those parts of the brain that support our inbuilt navigational skills are, as you said, shrinking. The picture is complicated because the human brain is astonishingly complicated, and many, many different parts of the brain are implicated in this. It's not just the hippocampus, though that is clearly very, very important. What I find immensely impressive is the extraordinary efficiency of the insect brain. Wonderful work is now being done exploring exactly how these insects, like the desert ant, use their little tiny brains. I mean, the desert ant has a brain of maybe 400,000 neurons. Human brain, 85 billion.
Yeah.
But that those 400,000 highly evolved insect neurons are doing a fantastic job.
Yeah.
One of the applications of this is in the development of extremely efficient robotic navigation systems.
Yeah. Well, I certainly, if ever I get lost, I know that you are the person, David, that I would be calling. David Barry, it's been an absolute delight for you to take us right across this map. Thank you for joining me so much on What's Your Map?
Thank you so much for inviting me.
David's ability to navigate oceans without a computer in sight is truly a grand achievement. I also loved hearing about these desert ants doing a similar kind of navigation automatically in their much smaller brains. If only we could get a desert ant on as a guest next season to talk about the map they have in their brains. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Jerry Broughton, a map historian. This has been an Oculi Mundi exploration. The producer is Emily Uchida Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. Oculi Mundi is the online home of the Sunderland Collection of antique maps and atlases. You can read more about the Sunderland Collection and send suggestions for future maps to explore at oculi-mundi.com.